This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. As a gardener, you know I am one. I've talked about it, and I'm always worried about whether my plants are getting enough water, especially this dry spring. Do they need more fertilizer, compost, mulch? And if you're a garden enthusiast, you have, I'm sure, already been hard at work this spring with your shovel, your spade, your rake, your whatever goes on. But have you ever thought about adding your smartphone to that list of tools? There's a growing market of sensors, smart hose attachments, and even robot lawnmowers vying to help you with garden chores. It's the Internet of Things for plants. And they can monitor soil temperatures. They can send you notifications when it's time to water, even doing the watering for you when the detectors decide you should have some water. And from vegetable gardens to houseplants, from novices to experts, these devices and their apps purport to make keeping things alive easier. We're talking smart garden and smart tools. Do you already use an app to monitor and take care of your garden? How does your garden grow? If not, would you ever use technology to make watering or other garden chores easier? We want to hear from you. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, and of course you can tweet us at SciFry. Joining me now are a couple of garden gadget gurus. Andrew Gebhard is an associate editor at CNET. He's been reviewing the world of garden gadgetry. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Jason Aramburu is a CEO and founder of Eden. That's one of the companies making these devices and apps. He's an ecologist and soil scientist by training, and he says smart gardens could help save water in drought-plagued areas and even bring gardening and food growing to a wider audience. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. It's great to be here.
Andrew, tell us about where the garden gadget scene currently stands.
So it's currently that we have a wide variety of devices, as you were mentioning. We've got plant sensors, we have sprinklers, we have robot lawnmowers. And right now what we're starting to see is some of these things are starting to work together. The Rachio Eero is a sprinkler system that communicates with a couple of plant sensors via IFT, which is an online rule maker. The Green IQ, again, it's a sprinkler, communicates with plant sensors. And some of these devices even communicate with your smart home on a larger scale. So if your Nest Protect senses smoke, it can turn your sprinklers on, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that is kind of cool. Walk me through the actual experience of having one of these setups might be like on a daily basis. You just turn it on, set it, forget it, and it monitors your whole garden for you?
Well, it depends on the device. So I mentioned Rachio and Green IQ. Those are for like if you have an in-ground sprinkler system already, You have a dumb controller and you've got to program it and schedule it manually. With those guys, Rachio, Green IQ, Blossom, there's several of them out there that replace your dumb controller with a smart one. It's kind of a retrofit solution, and they monitor the weather and help you out. So when it rains, even if you're scheduled to for your sprinklers to go off, it won't go off.
I understand. I get it. Let me bring in Jason, who's part of the company Eden that makes some of the devices Andrew was talking about. You have a background in ecology, right? So what brought you to this point of the gadgetry?
That's right. Well, I studied ecology at Princeton. And after college, I actually went and worked over in Africa with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I was working on a project funded by them to help small farmers improve their fertilizer usage and also their yield. And, you know, we were working with people who are farming for a living, but it turns out they were, you know, really growing in very similar conditions to a home garden. About a half acre sized plot growing vegetables, and these people were growing them for food. And what was really interesting to me was that a lot of those farmers had second jobs. They were teachers or they worked in a store or something. And I thought to myself, you know, maybe this is an interesting model for the developed world. Maybe we can all have normal day jobs and grow some of our own food in our spare time.
So how do the sensors work? What are the sensors monitoring in the soil?
So the Eden Garden Sensor has five sensors. It measures temperature, humidity, and light levels. And then in the soil, it measures the soil's moisture and it measures the soil's nutrition. And it does that by sending an electrical pulse into the soil and detecting how that pulse is affected by fertilizer and water. It's a technique that's been used by a lot of really large commercial farms for a few years now, but hasn't really penetrated to consumers yet.
And so you can hook up your garden hose to one of the sensors and it will turn on the water automatically when it detects it needs water.
Exactly. So now we have two products on the market. We just launched our second product, the Eden Water Valve. And that's actually a replacement for your dumb hose end timer. It goes in place of that timer, connects to your garden hose and then to your irrigation system. And it actually pairs with the sensor in your soil. And it waters your plants only when they need it. So only when your soil moisture gets to a certain threshold where your plants need water.
Does it send me a signal to my cell phone saying what it's doing or the
exactly.
state of what my soil is, how wet it is, how much nutrients are in it?
Exactly. It'll send you a push notification when your soil needs watering, and then you can actually go into the app on your iOS device or your Android device and see exactly what the moisture levels are, what the temperature is, the humidity, and you can see also if that's in the ideal range for your plants or not.
Is this, Andrew is and Jason, is this something, you know, that's going to take away from the pleasure of gardening? I mean, I don't think for me it's going to. I'd love to know when it needs water or any, you know, it needs things. Or are purists going to say, hey, you know, that's the whole point of gardening. You're taking that fun away.
I don't think it will, because when we first started this project, we interviewed thousands of gardeners. And what we overwhelmingly found was gardeners love to be in their garden, experience the beauty of a garden in full bloom. They're not so crazy about all the work that's required to do that. So I think it, you know, we designed it not to get in the way of the gardening experience, but really to augment it and create a totally new experience.
Mm-hmm. And I'll agree with Jason. The most pieces of the process are still intact. You're still going to have to plant yourself. You're
right.
Still going to have to fertilize yourself. It's really a lot of pieces of the smart garden are taking away the menial tasks like watering and remembering to water. And they can help you also keep track of that by making a calendar for you. So it's more like a smart garden assistant. The smart garden certainly isn't at the point yet where it's ready to take over your garden for you.
Are we talking about affordable prices here?
Well, we designed the Eden system to be affordable. The sensor retails for $99, and the valve retails for $69. And we'll be launching a bundle as well if you want to get them together.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we'll be seeing competitors coming out. We're going to be seeing more of these sensors coming out. Let me go to a couple of phone calls if I have time to see how people are reacting to this. Let's go to Huntsville, Alabama. Hi, welcome to Science Friday, Hal.
Hey, long-time listener, and I wanted to say you guys are actually very spot on about being self-sufficient, and just wanted to, I guess, back up and agree with the praises that you guys are singing. The idea is to work smart, not hard, and I can't wait to see where we go with a fully robotic garden. That would be very good. But I use a timer on my watering system, and it's a great thing to sync up with the iPhone because you can actually turn it off or on depending on if you have to leave the garden or the house immediately. And then I was also curious as to would your products that you will be selling also be able to do different types of plants like rice, how it needs a lot more water as opposed to tomatoes or any kind of basic root system vegetable?
Good question.
Absolutely, yeah. We have a database of thousands of different garden plants as well as food crops and turf grasses as well. So in the app, you can actually select what you want, and it tunes the system to the needs of that plant. What we can also do is actually recommend plants for your garden that are really well-suited to the conditions there.
What about pest control? I'm waiting for a drone that will chase the squirrels and the deer away from my veggies. Is that something you think might be in the realm of possibility?
You know, Ira, I can't really disclose future products that we might bring to market, but what I can say is that we're in discussions with a couple of very large companies who make robotic equipment in the lawn and garden space, and they're very interested to offer an integrated solution where, yes, everything is, you know, totally automated, where your pest control is automated, where your fertilizer delivery is automated, and it's all controlled via your app. And you know, this isn't something that's ready today, but within a couple of years, we'll definitely see it.
Andrew, you expect to see this stuff?
Actually, yeah. There's a small pest control device you can buy now on Amazon. It's called Scarecrow, and we haven't tested it out, so we don't know how good it is. But it actually senses motion in your yard and will spray the animal with a stream of water to try and scare it away. So whether that works on any animal other than cats, I don't know, but it's at least some form of deterrent.
I think it would work on squirrels. Yeah, I don't know about the deer.
Would be good, right?
I think from my experience squirting squirrels with my water, you know, my watering device.
Absolutely. And it really points to a need that we've identified, too, that gardeners of today don't want to spray and pray, meaning they don't want to just cover their garden in toxic chemicals and pray that it kills all the bugs. They want something more sustainable.
Absolutely. Well, good luck to you. And I'm waiting for the product that attracts hummingbirds to my garden. I'm waiting for that one to come out. Also, Andrew,
hummingbirds are good luck.
That's right. Andrew Gebhardt is associate editor at CNET, and Jason Aramburu is a CEO and founder of Eden. That's EDYN, and one of the companies currently making garden sensors and apps. We're going to take a break. When we come back, biologist Craig Venter is here to talk about pioneering work on creating the first map of the human genome over a decade ago. He was on the program 13 years ago. We're going to come back, check in and on some of the predictions he made and we talked about, and see how well that's all working out. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In the 1990s, there was a race between two groups to create the first map of the human genome. There was the U.S. government-backed Human Genome Project, started in 1990, and Celera Genomics, a private biotechnology company founded by biologist Craig Venter. And it began working in 1998, and Venter's group published their results in 2001. The government officially announced completion of its project in 2003. Well, back in 2003, Craig Venter joins us to talk about some of his predictions for the technology. And all throughout this year, to celebrate Science Friday's 25th anniversary, we're dipping into the sci-fi archives to see how things have changed over these 25 years. And Craig Venter joins us again today to talk about how far genomics technology and costs have come down in the past decade. And these days, Craig Venter is founder and CEO of the J. Craig Venter Institute in La Jolla, California. And if you have questions you'd want to have sent our way, you can give us a call, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Well, thank you, Ira, and happy 25th anniversary.
Well, thank you very, very much. How has the field and industry of genomics changed since 2003? Is it enough that you could sum it up?
Well, I'd say the technology has changed to a wonderful extent, both on the computer front and the DNA sequencing front. Our knowledge of the genome hasn't changed a whole lot since 2003, but it's about to start changing rapidly now.
Well, why do you say that?
Well, the one of the key things for understanding the genome is to get very large numbers of genomes so we can understand out of our 6.2 billion or so letters of genetic code, understanding the less than 3% that we have difference amongst the entire human population. So with all that information, we need very large data sets to understand the differences and their significance. And that's where the cost and the speed for sequencing has had such an immediate impact. So 2 years ago, we passed the threshold that I'd set of getting below $2,000 for a human genome. And we started a human longevity for-profit company just a little over 2 years ago, and we're sequencing a genome now roughly every 15 minutes versus the first one that took 9 months and cost $100 million. So we can now afford to do large numbers of them and make these kind of correlations for the first time.
And now people can send away and get a little bit of their own genome in the mail, which they couldn't do before.
That's right. There's a lot of places that will give you partial information, but a key thing to get it done completely accurately is important for not only understanding the data, but making good clinical interpretations as well.
When you created your first human genome map, you used something called the shotgun method. How does that differ from what you're using today or what is being used today?
Well, basically, the shotgun method was blowing the genome apart into little tiny fragments and sequencing those, and then using the computer to reassemble that into the genome sequence. So basically, since 1995, when we did the first genome, and certainly after using that for the human genome, it's literally the only way that genomes are sequenced. The only difference between what we do today and what we did in 2001, so in 2001, we had to sequence the genome de novo and actually assemble it back into a sequence. Mm-hmm. Today, what makes the reads faster and cheaper are making very short reads, so only around 100 letters of genetic code, and those aren't adequate for a de novo assembly of the genome. So basically, everybody cheats and they line up those fragments either on my reference genome or a composite one that NCBI has put together. And you do it sort of just by matching the fragments versus truly assembling the genome. So we're cheating until technology allows us to actually do routinely what we could do 15 years ago.
Interesting. When you were on the show back in 2003, this was after you left, you were fired from Celera, the company you founded. And this is what you said about the split.
There was a fundamental disagreement on the future directions. I was apparently the only one that believed that genomics was the future of what would change in preventative medicine, changing how we practice medicine, even the cost of medicine. The heads of the parent corporation of Celera thought that going into making pharmaceuticals was the only way to go in terms of getting return on their money. It was just a disagreement in direction, and I let it be known that I would probably move on, and they helped make that happen.
And it was fortuitous that you left.
I think it was. I'm still here, but Celera is not. So
there you have it.
So I think that's called the tail of the tape or something.
It's a Steve Jobs story. You and he had the same, you know, you left, came back, started your own company.
Well, it's, you know, creative minds working at the edge. It's not always easy to get investors to think in that same out-of-the-box fashion. So it's a challenge to do so. And we're pushing the limits now at human longevity. But it's exciting, and we're starting to make so many unique discoveries about ourselves that it's going to be a very different world trying to understand our DNA software.
I'll bet. Back then in 2003, you had a prediction about how widespread personalized genome maps would be. Let's hear what you said back then. You have written that you think that within the near future, everyone will be able to walk into their doctor's office, maybe give them a sample of some part of their body and get their genome back for a fee. How close are we to that?
Well, I predicted that that would happen in 10 years. Obviously, we need some major technology changes when you think of the public genome effort requiring $3 to $5 billion to get one genome. Obviously, we have a long way to go if we're going to get everybody's genome that way. That doesn't make it very feasible. Even the Celera effort cost on the order of $100 million and took 9 months. I mean, we've made it an international goal to get a $1,000 human genome, which we think is the range the technology has to drive things to make it so lots of people can afford, insurance companies will afford, to have a genome sequence for each person. this is something that only has to be done once in your life. It's not a diagnostic test you keep going in to do over and over again. So I predicted it will start to happen with children born in the hospital, that before they leave the hospital, their parents will have the option of having that information.
It hasn't quite happened quite yet, but do you still believe in that prediction?
Well, in fact, the few things I said there were wrong, but the others were, it's now 13 years instead of 10. This year, we're actually rolling out those efforts to do newborn genome sequencing, and we've been doing major diagnostic sequencing on children with undiagnosed diseases in hospitals, and we're much closer to making it a standard for healthcare. One of the things I said that was absolutely wrong is I predicted that we'd only need to get our genome sequenced once. And one of the findings at Human Longevity as we sort through the genetic code using our machine learning tools is we can actually predict your age from your genome sequence. I wouldn't have guessed that 13 years ago. In fact, I clearly didn't. So in fact, the notion that you only get your genome sequenced once unless you have cancer is going to probably end up being not correct. We're finding specific changes in the genome as we age, as I said, to the point where we can predict your age relatively accurately straight from your genetic code. So understanding those changes could be the key to understanding how we age and why we age.
Can you predict my death then from the genetic code?
So that's something of hot discussion right now, and technically I'm not down to the hour and the day, but probably within a few years, we think that's possible. It's not clear how many people want to know that. You know, there may be other people that want to know that about you, but you may not want to know it.
Well, the insurance company's going to want to know that, probably.
Well, certainly, you know, it's interesting. We're having a lot of discussions between human longevity and life insurance companies. And one thing you have in common with your life insurance company is they want you to live a long time and you want to live a long time. You're betting against yourself and they're betting for you.
Yeah.
But they're both going to be interested in that information. I think the challenge will be if insurance companies have that data and you don't, you're at a disadvantage. And if you have that data and they don't, they're at a disadvantage. So I think it's going to be an interesting period to make sure that there's sort of equilibrium, that you can't sort of fool the insurance system by having an idea when you're going to die or what you're going to die from or what you're not going to die from. Because that could throw the economics of the exchange into a wild chaos. So I think it's going to be important for both you and your insurance company to have that information to because what we're finding is the information can be predictive and you can do something about those predictions to change the outcomes.
How accurate are the predictions? Are they 50, 75, 100%?
Well, it depends which ones. I think one way that I think it's important to look at just straight genomic data is in statistical probabilities, not in yes-no answers. And so we can predict your age with an accuracy maybe plus or minus 5 years right now. It's not a precise element. But should get more precise with time. Predicting when people would die is it's interesting because it's actually there's genetic changes that we see that actually cause people to die early, and those predictions are certainly within 5 or 10 years right now of accurate predictions, but what they give us is a chance to change those outcomes. These become the new targets for pharmaceuticals and actions So you don't die from these things pre-coded into your genome.
Yeah, unless you're texting while driving, and there's a whole different ballgame. One of the biggest questions that comes up all the time, and it came back up way back then in 2003, is who owns the genes? Can a company patent them or patent it? And this is what you said back then.
What was used by our early critics were saying that we were going to patent the human genome, even though they knew that was false. So It's been a complicated issue mixed with politics. But as somebody who is now in his mid-50s, I'm delighted that some companies are patenting genes associated with potential new therapeutics. What I'd like to see is less of it on a speculative basis and more of it when there was a direct link to making a drug. I think that if that was the case, all of us would be a lot happier with the patent office.
Talking with Craig Venter on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. In 2013, the courts ruled that Myriad Genetics could not patent the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes that are related to breast and ovarian cancer. Should companies have to pay royalties on a gene, Craig?
Well, I don't think anybody should in terms of diagnostics. And in fact, you know, doing genome sequencing would have put that era to an end anyway, because we can sequence your entire genome and have your sequence of every gene for far less than it costs to just get your BRCA1 gene tested. And it's not something could have been covered by patents, because we couldn't be told, well, we can't look at that piece of the genome when we're sequencing it. But I think we were all delighted with the Supreme Court ruling and that you cannot patent naturally occurring DNA. And I think that's really opened up the diagnostic and the genomic arena. So we were all concerned the genome would get balkanized, like what's happening with BRCA1 and BRCA2.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Your latest work is on the synthesizing DNA, and you actually created some synthetic DNA, put it in a cell recently. I remember we talked about it. How close are you to building a cell from the ground up, you know, from the cell membrane, the organelles, everything else in nature, and putting in the genetic material? Or is that not something that is on your radar?
It's an interesting idea. You know, people keep talking about life from scratch. And it's sort of like when people talk about baking a cake from scratch. It doesn't mean they're going to go out and make the flour from carbon and CO2 and water molecules. It sort of means not using a cake mix. Life from scratch sort of has lots of different meanings depending on who's saying it. You can't have life without our genetic software. So just putting proteins together in a lipid bag, even if you get metabolism from it, as some people have, that's not life. It can't sustain itself. The proteins die off. And so without genetic software, you cannot have life, and certainly self-replicating life. So we've focused totally on the building and design of that software and just using existing cells to boot up the software to create totally new life forms. At some stage, it would certainly be interesting if we could put the DNA together with the right lipid bubbles and maybe a starter reaction of ribosomes and things so you could start making proteins and getting cells that way, because the more we can break things down to basic components, the more we will have to understand them to get it to work. And that's what the big finding was with the cell we just spent the last 5 years trying to design. We tried to design a minimal cell with just the genes necessary for life. And it turns out the last 20 years of science has been misleading because we all just sort of subtracted one genome from another and got down to a set of no genes.
Yeah. I have to interrupt you there. We'll come back and talk about that. Yeah. We did talk about how very few genes you needed to keep that cell going. Talking with Craig Venter, founder and CEO of the Craig Venter Institute in La Jolla. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. My guest is Craig Venter. He's biologist and founder and CEO of J. Craig Venter Institute in La Jolla, California. And Craig, I don't mean to try to beat a dead horse on this. I just want to see if I understand correctly. Do you think it's too big a hot button issue to make a living cell from scratch, like you say, baking a cake, to try that? It's just not worth the heartache you might have to go through to create that.
Well, no, I don't think it's a hot button issue at all. I think various researchers are trying to replicate what they might have as origins of life. So Jack Sozak at Harvard has been making small lipid soap bubbles and putting self-replicating RNA molecules in them. And the bubbles sort of separate into daughter bubbles, and the RNA molecules replicate themselves. So showing that, you know, those could be early origins of life. We're dealing with things several billions of years later, even with the most minimal cell. So it's not like we're recapitulating the first creation of life with these basic elements. I just don't think it's that relevant of a question, given that everything derives from the DNA software itself. And I'm sure in a few years we will have universal cells that can read the ranges of types of genetic code to boot up all kinds of new cells. So I think, you know, once you have computers, you don't go back to an abacus.
I see. That's sort of going in reverse. If you get everything you need out of the DNA, why go back and try to make the cell? Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Barry, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So I'm thinking about all of this technology we have with respect to acquiring information about the human genome, and we've had a lot of this information before, and I'm wondering how maybe Mr. Venter's ideas are regarding this idea of eugenics and how that's been used in the past and how it might be used differently now that we have this technology, and also about this idea of the CRISPR technology, and maybe he can elucidate a little bit about what that is and how it might be related to the topic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Well, Barry, both interesting questions. So eugenics sort of came to a peak in, I think, the 1930s, long before we had DNA sequence or even knowledge that DNA was the genetic material. But people wanted to do different types of selection, or thinking that they're going to eliminate populations that had criminal or bizarre behavior. So it's something that has been of concern to everybody since the start of genomics. And I think thus far we've been very good to keep that out of it. But as we understand more and more of ourselves and how our personalities and behaviors and brain structures are programmed from DNA, we're going to have to be careful we don't start down some slippery slope. CRISPRs are a DNA editing tool, and they're a fantastic discovery, a fantastic tool for making small changes in the genetic code. There's many people thinking and talking about doing this with the human genome. I personally think this is very dangerous to do until we have a far more complete understanding of the human genome. We were just talking about a minimal bacterial cell where we don't understand a third of the genes with less than 500 genes in a cell. We know less than 1% of real information about the human genome, human genes, and it would be complete human experimentation to start making changes in genes to see what the outcome of those would be in living humans. So I think we need to be extremely cautious and at least wait till the consensus of our knowledge is sufficient that we wouldn't end up doing grave harm to people by making changes that we don't know what they really mean.
As you know, there are diseases that are based on simple genetic mutations in some of the genes that could be replaced by CRISPR. And you're saying be careful in moving forward in that direction.
Well, if you look at other species where people have studied things, so for example, if you're looking at a structural protein in the wing of a fruit fly and say, we understand the damage and that we're going to correct that error in that protein and that gene, turns out that same protein and gene early on in the development of a fruit fly play a key developmental role, and it's just later in the fruit fly's life, it ends up a structural protein in the wing. So assuming that every gene only has a single function is probably the fastest road to hell in genomics. So we need to understand all the functions of genes and how changing them will alter other genes, other biological functions in humans. We're not simple linear creatures, and we have to understand how changing one note changes the entire orchestra.
Yeah, because we found that we have very, very much less genetic material than we thought we did, and that it must all be working together in different ways, not as simply as we thought.
Yes, the gene-centric view of the world, we're hoping will die away, and we'll talk about the genome-centric view of how all these parts work together in unison to create ourselves and our bodies.
Well, in the few minutes I have left, minute or two, you want to make any predictions for 13 years from now when we have you back?
Well, I hope I'm around to come back in 13 years.
Me too.
from my genome, I'll cautiously make that prediction. It's I think in 13 years, genomics will be a very key fundamental part of the practice of medicine. Completely in cancer. You won't be able to do anything in cancer without understanding the genetic code. And I think it will rapidly move into other areas as we get this. 13 years from now, we're going to have tens, if not hundreds of millions of genomes in databases that will give us a very different view of humanity than we have today.
We'll be crowdsourcing big data. The genome will be big data.
It's already big data. So just the 26,000 genomes we've sequenced at HLI in the last 2 years, that represents 3.4 petabytes of data. Indexing the entire internet in 2014 was only around 12 to 14 petabytes. So we've already surpassed the big data definition in genomics.
And one last question. What big project are you working on that we're going to be hearing about?
Well, the key thing we're doing is integrating, actually measuring clinical tests with MRI and some of the other measurements we do, linking that to the human genome to greatly increase the understanding and being able to do predictive preventative medicine. We're discovering cancers very early at stage zero and stage one when they're completely curable. Instead of at stage four, where maybe you got a 50-50 chance of survival.
And we'll see the fruits of that result soon?
I think every few months that go on, we're going to see more and more results of it. I think by the end of this year, there'll be major new programs that we have that make it much more cost-effective for people to get cancer genomic information to help save their lives.
We'll be looking forward to it, Dr. Venter. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Ira, it's always great to talk to you. So, again, happy anniversary.
Thank you, and good luck in your work. J. Craig Venter is founder and CEO of the Venter Institute in La Jolla, California. Speaking of DNA, DNA is the storage locker for our genetic code, and why not convert the ones and zeros of a digital code into the AGTCs of the genetic code and store those digital information in our DNA? A team of engineers did just that. The engineers were able to turn digitized photos and videos into DNA code. And then they were able to retrieve the info out of DNA, which is very important if you're going to use it as a storage medium, with 100% accuracy. Very important step. So why not create a hard drive out of DNA? My next guest is here to tell us how to do that. Georg Seelig is part of that team, and he's an associate professor of electrical and computer science at the University of Washington. He joins us from KUOW. Welcome.
Welcome. It's good to be here.
So the first question is, why do you do this? We have thumb drives that can store terabytes of information. Is DNA a great storage medium?
I think it is. I mean, there's sort of three main reasons why that's true. The first one is it's really small. It's really dense, so you can just cram a lot of information into very small space. The second is that it lasts for a long time. I mean, we can retrieve DNA from very old, like 100,000-year-old fossils. And the third one is that DNA, as we've just, well, you've just talked about, is sort of our genetic material, and so we'll always be interested in reading DNA. So it's not like a floppy disk that 10 years from now nobody will be able to look at.
In your experimentation, tell us what you did, what kind of photos, how you were able to digitize the DNA.
Okay, yeah, so the process is actually quite simple, right? So anytime you store image or video or something in a computer, you've already digitized it into zeros and ones. And then what we need to do is translate these zeros and ones to A's and C's and G's and T's. So you could do that by just saying, you know, an A is 00, T is 01, G is 10, and C is 11. And so you just translate zeros and ones to letters. Then you essentially ask a DNA synthesis company to make strands of DNA for you that have, you know, the right series of letters. You get the DNA in the mail, actually. You store it in a fridge as of now, but, you know, in different settings in the future. And then you kind of sequence it back to read the information in that test tube.
Wow. And it will stay for how long?
It really depends on how you treat it. I mean, DNA can be very, very stable, like thousands of years, if it's kept away from water. Mm. If it's in water, it won't last, you know, very long.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Georg Seelig at the University of Washington in Seattle. How do you then get the information back out? What kind of mechanisms can you use to retrieve it from the DNA?
Okay, that's sort of a two-step process. First, you use a technique called PCR, which allows you to essentially pick out, you know, if you have in your pool of DNA many different files and you just want to read one, you can use PCR to sort of do random access and pick out just a specific file you like and amplify that. And then you take what you amplify, then you put it on a DNA sequencer, which is exactly the same, you know, type of device that Dr. Venter is using. And so then that allows you to read the information back.
And then give me an idea how much data you can store in DNA.
So in our paper, we just stored about 150 kilobytes, which is not a lot, obviously. I think it was four images. But I think that's really changing very rapidly. So I think this 10 years ago, 20 years ago, people were able to synthesize maybe, you know, a few strands of DNA corresponding to a few characters that you could store. And I think in, you know, just a few years, we'll be able to store orders of magnitude more data.
Give me an idea what you mean. How many pictures, photos, videos?
Oh, so
is terabytes we're talking about?
Oh, I think eventually, for sure. I mean, I think eventually exabytes are realistic. So I think we can store, you know, not next year, but maybe 10 years from now or so, I think we can store like data center sized amounts of information in DNA.
Data, and a whole data center size, and how much space would that take?
I mean, an exabyte, if you just look at the DNA alone with a little bit of packaging, you could argue that it would be like a sugar cube. I think realistically, you know, you'll have to build infrastructure around that sugar cube, so the effective density will be less than that, but it could be really small. I mean, it's definitely denser than any storage material that's out there, including magnetic tape, which is currently sort of the gold standard.
So you could take a whole data center and put it in a sugar cube size. Thing.
I think eventually that will happen. I think that the potential is there, and this application, I mean, the key thing that needs to happen to get there is that you need to make writing DNA, so DNA synthesis, much, much cheaper, like a million times cheaper. And, you know, there's a lot of questions as to how to do that, but I think it can be done. And if we do it, then, you know, this becomes realistic.
And you're working with Microsoft on this, are you not?
Exactly. They're
They've got so much in business in the cloud now, they must be interested in data storage.
Exactly. So we're actually, you know, a team. So my expertise is kind of on the DNA side. I'm actually a synthetic biologist by training. And then I'm working with people at Microsoft, Karin Strauss, Doug Carmine, and in my own department in computer science with Louis Sezi and their computer architects. And really what they are thinking about is how to improve storage. So I think there's a real interest commercially in making storage cheaper and denser.
Well, Georg Seelig, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Associate Professor of Electrical and Computer Sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle. A reminder, this science club is in session and I want you to take a sample. And what should you be sampling?
My name is Benjamin Blyer, and I'm a surgeon scientist at Harvard Medical School who specializes in treating patients with sinus problems. The way we currently figure out if people have sinusitis is by looking in the nose, performing CAT scans, and sometimes even surgery, where we take samples of the sinus tissue and have a pathologist look at it under the microscope. Wouldn't it be great if we had a simpler way to figure out if a patient had nasal and sinus problems? Well, that's where my research comes in. What I sample is boogers. Well, technically in my field, we call it nasal mucus. We do this so we can identify specific molecules in the mucus, which can give us a lot of information about the patient, including what kind of sinusitis they have, why they keep getting infections, and a whole variety of other things. The best part is that unlike surgery, sampling mucus is painless and can be done in the office with essentially no anesthesia. By sampling something most people find frankly gross, we're trying to improve patient care, prevent unnecessary antibiotic use, and best of all, save the nasal microbiome.
And there you go. You don't have to go sample boogers if you don't want to, but go out there and sample and have a great time on our website at sciencefriday.com/scienceclub. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios at the City University of New York. Our digital team includes Julie Leibach, Chow Tu, Brandon Echter, and Daniel Peterschmidt. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer. At the controls here are the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.